DW Deutsche Welle. World Link.
Hello and welcome to this edition of DW's World Link, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. In Bonn, I'm Neil King.
And I'm Charlotta Lomas. On this week's show, a Gaza resident speaks out about the Israeli offensive.
We talk to an OSCE worker monitoring the crash site of MH17 in Ukraine. And we'll also be hearing more about one of the Dutch victims who had dedicated his life to helping others.
He was one of those people that's very vivacious, young, energetic, enthusiastic. Pim was one of those people that was dedicated to making the world a better place and with a particular passion about HIV.
Plus, Kurds in Iraq who say the time has finally come for a Kurdish state.
These stories coming up on WorldLink.
You're listening to DW's WorldLink. I'm Neil King.
And I'm Charlotta Lomas.
And we start this week's show in Gaza, where Israel's offensive against Hamas has left more than 800 people dead, many of them civilians. On Thursday, a UN school where refugees had sought shelter from the Israeli bombings came under fire. At least 16 people were killed in that attack alone. It's the fourth time a UN facility has been hit in Gaza since the fighting began on July 8th. Earlier, I spoke to freelance Palestinian journalist Abir Ayoub in Gaza City, who reports for several international media outlets, including Israel's Haaretz newspaper. I started by asking her how the Israeli offensive has impacted daily life there. Please note that we were forced to use a voiceover because the phone line was so bad.
People cannot leave, they can't go do shopping.
People cannot leave. They can't go shopping for the basics such as food and the like. One week ago, the main electricity generator was hit, so there are blackouts. It's been more than 7 years that we had a blackout crisis when we had electricity 8 hours a day. Now it's 3 hours a day.
Okay, you described the impact it's having on everyday life in terms of electricity cuts. People can't go out to get supplies. What about the impact on the civilian population who have lost their homes in the attacks? How are they coping?
Maybe more than half of the people in the Gaza Strip have now fled to the camps. Some went to schools, and the churches and the mosques have also opened their doors for the refugees. And you can imagine these thousands who have fled have nothing from their houses. No food, no clothes, no sheets, no blankets, nothing. And most are in critical shape physically because they rely on humanitarian aid provided by individuals and families in the Gaza Strip so they can get food and water.
Abir, it is said that the Israelis make advance phone calls to warn inhabitants that their house will be targeted. Can you confirm this?
This happens, but it doesn't happen as a rule, I would say. If they want to demolish the house as a kind of punishment, they will call people and ask them to evacuate. But in most of the cases, houses are hit without warning. And what's even more disgusting is that sometimes they warn people by hitting the house with a warning shot. You'll find people who were killed while they were sleeping in their houses. There was a building beside my house that was targeted 2 days ago, and there's still a body stuck in the rubble. So if you walk by these buildings, you'll find a body with two legs showing in between the rubble.
Abir, Israel says it tries to keep the civilian casualties as low as possible, and yet the death toll is rising by the day. Is this because Hamas is hiding behind civilians and operating in densely populated areas, or is the Israeli army more indiscriminate in their attacks than they claim?
No, Israel is not being discriminate in its attacks because Gaza is so small. And if you hit densely populated areas, even if you're targeting one house, you will affect at least four other houses around it. I'm in Gaza City and I can hear every single bombardment, no matter how far away it is, because Gaza is so small. And even mosques were targeted and hospitals were demolished. I just can't imagine how Hamas can use mosques and hospitals as military units. It doesn't make sense.
Abir, some describe Gaza as an open-air prison because its border with Egypt and Israel is virtually sealed. Given this conflict now, are any managing to leave the Strip at all? And is anybody prepared to give them shelter and care for them?
Never. Only people with second passports. They could leave during the first days of the offensive through the Erez border, which is controlled by Israel. And unfortunately, the Egyptians are sealing the Rafah border, even for those who entered ahead of the clashes. The Gaza Strip was virtually closed before, but now it's even worse. The borders are sealed.
How do people in Gaza feel about Hamas's role in all of this?
I would say that people are supporting Hamas because Hamas are a part of the society. And also during this war, it became more clear that Israel does not want peace with the Palestinians. Israel wants to collectively punish the more than 1.8 million Palestinians living in Gaza. People outside say that we, the people in Gaza, are angry with Hamas because of what's been happening. But I ask myself, why should we be angry with Hamas? Is Hamas killing our children or targeting houses and hospitals? And it's not just Hamas that is resisting. Israel has been imposing a blockade on the Gaza Strip for more than 7 years, preventing any raw materials from entering Gaza. So what's happening is a very natural reaction from these resistance groups to defend their civilians. And when Israel talks about the right of self-defense, there shouldn't be any double standards. If Israel has the right to defend itself, then the people in Gaza also have the right to defend themselves.
Do you get the sense that the Israeli offensive will make people turn towards Hamas?
I witnessed the two wars that came before. And surprisingly, the popularity of Hamas increased during the First and the Second War. And this is what's going to happen now.
How did people in Gaza feel when Hamas started firing rockets at Israel? Did they see this new war coming?
It wasn't Hamas who started the war. It was Israel. When they accused Hamas of kidnapping the settlers in Hebron and they started to retaliate against Hamas. However, there's no evidence that it was Hamas who killed the three settlers. And they started arresting the prisoners who were released in the Gilad Shalit swap, and that pushed Hamas towards escalating the situation. If you go against Hamas supporters in the West Bank, you can't expect Hamas in Gaza to stay silent.
Abir, I'd like to end the interview on a personal note. You, as a journalist reporting from Gaza, you've got a professional approach to all you see, no matter how horrendous it is. But just how difficult is it for you to keep going as a journalist, given the extent of the suffering that you've seen and witnessed?
I don't think this is a contradiction because I'm a journalist and I cover what's going on. But at the same time, I'm a Palestinian at the end of the day. I work for professional newspapers, but every time I go to work, I'm worried I might be the next one to be killed. But that doesn't mean that I'm going to stop working as a journalist, especially since I'm working for international outlets.
That was Abir Ayoub talking to me from Gaza there, and the voiceover was provided by Helen Sini.
Fighting in Ukraine has flared again while OSCE monitors continue to gather information about the Malaysian airliner, which crashed last week. Flight MH17 was en route to Kuala Lumpur from Amsterdam when it was shot down near Donetsk, a stronghold of pro-Russian rebels. 298 people on board died. So far, 200 bodies have been sent to the Netherlands to begin the process of identification.
Earlier, we spoke with Michael Botchukiv, spokesman for the OSCE Special Monitoring Mission to Ukraine. He gave us an update from the crash site.
This is day 7 for us here at the crash site. We have been doing most days. We've come with a group of monitors of about 12. The kind of common cycle of the day is we do visit various impact areas. We allow the experts some of our resources, you know, we accompany them to have a very close-up view of the site, of especially a fuselage. We visited a site which we had not visited previously, and it was quite astonishing in the sense that there were very large intact pieces of fuselage, probably the biggest pieces we've seen so far, including the biggest piece landed in a very heavily wooded area and was concealed almost entirely. In addition, we of course note the scattering of personal belongings, of everything from catering equipment to books, to seat cushions. It's spread over such a wide area. Yeah, and then of course notable is that there's no activity, at least that we can see, of any recovery effort. It's basically us, a small security detail, and quite a big group of journalists. So in that sense, it's quite extraordinary.
So how much access have you had to the site since the crash?
A lot, actually. Of course, day one was not the best day for us, but as the days progressed, we were able to see more and more. You know, a lot of that has been by foot because of the dispersal pattern of the aircraft. This requires very meticulous kind of walking over grass and through wooded areas. Now, when we were out with the Malaysians, they did take an interest in two or three particular pieces of fuselage, which had puncture holes on them and burn marks, which we hadn't seen on other pieces of fuselage. So they took quite an interest in that. And
why is that? What does that indicate?
We don't know. We're not the experts. They are. And, you know, they will be sharing that information with their colleagues and whoever's leading the investigation. But, you know, it was enough for us to stop, take note, and take quite a few photographs.
Do you have any indication that the sites that you've been visiting may have been tampered with by the separatists?
No, we don't. And it's important to note that we're not here 24-7. There is a curfew, after all, and we can't be here in night hours. But we have noted marked differences in some of the sites. For example, what I'm looking at right now, there is a fairly big piece of fuselage that has been propped up. Some things have been moved around, but that could very well have been part of the process of recovery of human remains. The cockpit area, which is another major crash site where basically the cockpit and the start of the first class section fell and pancaked into a very compact piece. We did observe on one of our first few days here that there were men in uniform hacking away at that with a power saw. But once again, we can't draw any conclusions from that.
Have there been any issues with or barriers preventing you from doing your job so far?
Well, I mean, we're constrained in the sense that we have to pay attention to the general security situation. We are brought here by escort through many, many checkpoints. But, you know, on the whole, we have been speeded to our destinations and we're able to cover a fair amount of ground.
Michael, some bodies have been recovered and returned to their home countries, mm-hmm. but many are still missing. Why is that?
We have heard there's discrepancy in numbers. And of course, as we go about, you know, we're extremely careful where we walk. We're keeping a very sharp eye out for anything we see that may indicate human remains. In fact, we did see some small human remains yesterday and then again today. Hopefully you're getting the sense that it's such a very large area. It's a very topographically diverse area that it would take a huge amount of people or special equipment to spot some things. The other factor, of course, and I almost hesitate to say this, but, you know, the area I'm looking at right now with my own eyes, it was very, very severely burned. A lot of A1 jet aviation fuel came down here. It looks like it exploded on impact. And the Malaysians pointed out to us that this is a 17-year-old aircraft, so had aluminum wings, not the modern composite wings, but it appears to them that those wings have melted. It's hard even to describe, but it's just a big spot of black with lots of oil still left there.
So what is the OCE's official stance on the crash now? What happened exactly and who's responsible?
Well, that is not our our mandate to say who's responsible or what happened. We have been here on the ground for over 3 months now as a monitoring mission. We've reported on the gradual escalation here, the occupation of buildings. You may recall we had a very terrible period when 8 of our colleagues were being held captive for a month. And then we were tasked to do this. So we've increased our numbers for the time being here. And our mission is really to establish the facts, report on them, share that information with the 57 member states of the OSCE, which of course includes Germany. We are continuing to report on the security situation, and we're helping to facilitate things. We have relationships with many different entities that hold sway over this area, and we have been able to obtain access now for 4 different groups of experts. So that is our role at the moment, and we will continue to do this for as long as we're tasked to do it.
That was Michael Bochukiv talking to us from the MH17 crash site in Ukraine.
One of the tragedies of the shooting down of flight MH17 was the loss of HIV activists on their way to a conference in Australia. How many of the plane's passengers were heading to the conference has yet to be confirmed, but it is known that at least 6 delegates were aboard, including Pim de Koeyer from the Dutch charity Stop AIDS Now. Lindsay Melling has this report from Hove, England.
The meeting room where we have our regular face-to-face meetings.
For Anton Ofield Kerr, it's been a horrible week. He's head of policy at the International HIV/AIDS Alliance, an NGO which works with AIDS charities all over the world.
So every 6 months, the Dutch organisation Stop AIDS Now and the International HIV/AIDS Alliance would come together and plan and develop a joint work plan for the following year.
Last Thursday, he heard the terrible news that flight MH17 had been shot down over Ukraine and that people he worked with were on the plane.
And I was driving home when I got a text from one of the colleagues to say that we thought that some of our colleagues from Stop AIDS Now were on the flight. The first thing that's really difficult to come to terms with is we're so used to seeing disasters on television. You know, we're so used to seeing tragedies. And then to see pictures and to know that your friends and colleagues are involved, and I think it's been particularly difficult given the challenging situation at the crash scene and the challenge of accessing the bodies and bringing them back home.
Of the six delegates known to have been on the flight, it was Pim de Kaya that Anton worked with most closely.
He was one of those people that's very vivacious, young, energetic, enthusiastic. It was definitely his catchphrase. You know, I'm Pim, I'm passionate about policy. And so it was his personal brand. You could just tell that he got into the nitty-gritty of political processes and really enjoyed and thrived on them. Bringing an end to AIDS is the thing that is the work that brought us together. And Pim was one of those people that was dedicated to making the world a better place and with a particular passion about HIV. So his loss is felt not just in our team and our joint team with SAN and within our organisations, but in the broader community of advocates and activists that work on working to bring an end to HIV.
Loss of life is a fact of the work that they do, but the demise of flight MH17 has caused shock throughout the community.
We've lost many colleagues to HIV. It's one of those issues that, you know, is still very real. Still only around 50% of people who are positive have access to treatment. So many of us have experienced the loss of good friends, of strong colleagues, of activists. It's a part of the, in a way, the history and the fabric of the AIDS response. But I think what we lose is the fact that we do take life for granted. We do often take our friends and colleagues for granted. And when you lose them and you reflect on the work that they do, you really appreciate and value the difference that they made, both, you know, personally, as friends, as colleagues, but also to really big issues.
They are now working on a tribute to Pim and his fellow activists.
Pim and Martin, his colleague that was on the flight, and many of the other people that were there on their way to the AIDS conference, were people that dedicated themselves to making the world a better place. You know, they were selfless in the sense that they were passionate and committed to working for a common good and for, leaving the world a better place than where we find it. And that makes it particularly difficult to have lost them. But I think also the determination, it really does remind us of our determination to carry on doing the work that we do.
For Anton and the HIV/AIDS community, continuing their life's work is the greatest tribute to Pim and the others that lost their lives.
Lindsay Melling there, reporting from Hove, England.
With a worldwide population of 40 million, Kurds are the world's largest ethnic group without a homeland. In Iraq, conflict has led many Kurds to dream of an independent Kurdish state. But the perception of what this state could look like has changed over the years and across generations. Hermani G reports from the Kurdistan regional capital, Erbil.
During Ramadan, the area around Erbil's old bazaar comes alive after sunset, when people break their fast and gather at sidewalk tea houses well into the early hours of the morning, before another long day of fasting ahead. Despite the ongoing crisis in the rest of Iraq, the autonomous Kurdistan region is secure and peaceful, and has become a safe haven for Iraqis fleeing the unrest in Mosul, Tal Afar, and other nearby areas. But it wasn't that long ago that Kurds were fighting for their own survival. Recalled Shamal Hassan, sitting with friends at a tea house in the covered brick walkway that runs around the outside of the market.
There was a lot of discrimination and oppression of the Kurds, so we were fighting for peace, freedom and democracy.
Now in his early 60s, Hassan was a Peshmerga, a member of the Kurdish armed forces, in the mid-1970s, and fought against the Iraqi army in the mountains near Choman, a city 160 kilometers northeast of Erbil.
So many people, thousands of people, were killed fighting for a free Kurdistan. The aircraft came to bomb us with chemicals, napalm, everything. They were trying to genocide us. They were trying to kill every one of us. But the regional situation, the international situation, wasn't right to ask for independence. At that time, we just wanted our rights and our safety.
A lot has changed since those bad old days. In 1991, the international community established a no-fly zone that protected Iraq's Kurds from the worst atrocities of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath regime. Then in 2003, after the fall of Saddam, Kurdistan gained full autonomy from Baghdad and has been running its own affairs ever since. But it still isn't an independent nation. And that's an important difference, says 27-year-old Sardar, a tour guide from Erbil who didn't want to give his full name.
I like it to have our own country as the other nations in the world. Turk has countries, Fars has countries, Arab has so many countries. Why is not fair Kurdish have their own state?
At the beginning of July, Kurdistan Regional President Masoud Barzani asked the parliament to set a date for a referendum on Kurdistan's independence. If it passes, the region will declare itself a sovereign state and separate entirely from the rest of Iraq. And while that will be important for Kurdish identity, Sardar says it's not the only consideration.
Iraq has a very bloody history. Iraq is the most corrupt country in the world. Iraq has zero level of safety, zero level of security, zero level of everything. I face too many problems because I'm Iraqi. I'm known as a terrorist. I'm known as a robber. I'm known as so many bad things. So, of course, I hate it. When you see you get so many problems because of your being Iraqi, as to not get visa internationally, not very well respected, and it's not nice, of course. Also, if we get our own states, independent states, so then maybe we can have a better passport and it will be good for economy. Also, we have oil. And in terms of freedom, also will be different. For Kurdistan, it will be better.
Back at the bazaar, Shamal Hassan agrees, but says it wasn't always this way.
We used to look at the Iraqi Arabs as our big brothers. If we had our rights, we thought we could stay together. There's a guy in power now who was oppressed for decades under Saddam, but he came and did the same as Saddam. That's why we're asking for independence. After all this time, we've lost so much. So many people have been killed. And now we've come to believe that we can't live with them. We have experience with them. I used to say I was a Kurd from Iraq because I thought there was still a chance that we could live together. But now I just say I'm a Kurd.
That report was by Hamani G in Erbil, Iraq. You're listening to DW's Worldlink, where I'm Neil King.
And I'm Charlotta Lomas.
This is DW's WorldLink, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. In Bonn, I'm Neil King.
And I'm Charlotta Lomas. In this second half of the show, we meet some of society's outcasts, or castaways, a theme running through many of our reports. We'll be hearing from one of Vietnam's best-known critics of the government's close ties with China.
Plus, a man who was swallowed up and spat out by the Antarctic Sea.
And a Ugandan woman who was scarred for life in an acid attack.
There was this young, beautiful girl who suddenly had these injuries which were terrible. What struck me about her was her bravery. She was very brave and she would walk with her head high.
All this coming up in the next half hour.
This week, international leaders gathered at the Girls' Summit in London calling for an end to female genital mutilation. Meanwhile, in Iraq, the jihadist group ISIS has ordered the genital mutilation of all women between the ages of 11 and 46, the UN said on Thursday. FGM, as it is often referred to, involves cutting the external genitalia and sometimes the inner labia too, and an unknown number of girls and toddlers bleed to death in the process.
Many of the survivors suffer from chronic infections, incontinence and lifelong trauma. The practice is aimed at keeping women chaste and is widespread in Africa and the Middle East. But in Europe too, girls are at risk, at least 180,000 of them.
Yet among the African communities in Europe, attitudes are slowly changing, thanks in part to committed campaigners such as Zahra Nalele. Naomi Conrad met the Somali Dutch activist who has been fighting against FGM for decades. She sent us this report from Berlin.
Back in the 1990s, when Zahra Nalele first took up the fight against the men and women who mutilate babies and toddlers, her mother was dismayed.
In the beginning, she said that, you know, it is not suited to work about this work because you are against the people. They see for you as an enemy because you are against their tradition and their religion and their customs. So please avoid this one and look another work.
Zahra shrugs. She had decided to fight the practice of female genital mutilation, or FGM as it is commonly referred to, a procedure that involves cutting the external genitalia and sometimes stitching up the wound, leaving only a tiny opening for urine and blood to pass through. The long-term effects are terrible. Infections, incontinence, chronic pain and trauma. Many girls and babies bleed to death in the process that is widespread in both Africa and the Middle East, but also among migrant communities in Europe, including in the Netherlands, where Zahra had moved to complete a master's degree. Surely, her mother back in Somalia reasoned, Zahra could do better things with her European degree than fight a practice which was commonplace in her home country. Zahra ignored her pleas.
And I said to her, yeah, because I have started somewhere and it comes from my heart and I would like to go ahead. So I think when you are working such taboo things, it is very, very difficult.
She's in Berlin for a conference of FGM activists who work with African communities in Germany, the Netherlands, Sweden and the UK. The activists agree that attitudes are slowly changing. The new generation which has grown up in Europe is no longer prepared to put its daughters through the pain and suffering they themselves experienced. Some communities have given up FGM almost altogether. Some, but not all.
Last year, a mother came into the clinic. She lives in Berlin with her 5-year-old daughter, who spent the summer holidays with her father in Somalia.
Cornelia Strunz is a doctor at the Desert Flower Medical Center in Berlin, which offers reconstructive surgery and counseling to 3 to 4 victims of female circumcision every month. A huge banner dominates the entrance to the clinic. A black woman and her daughter smile down at the patients below.
The mother was afraid that her daughter might have been circumcised during the holidays. She was extremely concerned, but fortunately we were able to reassure her.
Two nurses walk past, pushing an old man in a bed as Strunz opens a nondescript door. Inside, a petite woman in her late 30s is sitting on a hospital bed. The woman, who prefers to remain anonymous, is recovering from the reconstructive surgery Dr. Strunz performed. As the telephone disrupts our interview, the woman shakes her head. No, she's not expecting a call. She shrugs. Her family never talked about the procedure they put her through when she was a baby, before her family moved from Eritrea to Germany in the early 1980s. She can't remember being cut.
She only knows she was about a year old and that her family took her to a local hospital.
I had to ask them outright, you see. People don't talk about it. Maybe it's because they can't justify it. Many girls die when they're put through it. That's something that's hard to justify. Well, I don't think you can. Maybe that's why it's so taboo.
Und deswegen ist es mehr oder weniger ein Tabuthema.
She decided to undergo the surgery because she's planning to get married soon. Should she have a daughter of her own, she would never put her through FGM. And the same goes for the other women in her family, she says. Back in central Berlin, FGM activist Sahra nods proudly. It's down to activists like her that attitudes are changing. Even her mother's, who once opposed her work so vehemently.
Now she's died, but anyway she was respecting afterwards what I have did. She said, oh, I got the news from the radio. I have seen in the television, they were talking about the circumcision. Things like that, you know, it was really very important, yeah. But it was very difficult.
She smiles. It's a quiet, content smile.
Naomi Conrad there, reporting from Berlin.
From FGM to acid attacks. Every year, around 1,500 acid attacks are recorded worldwide, and 25 to 30 of those occur in Uganda. The victims, the majority of whom are women, are left with horrendous burns across their faces and bodies, requiring expensive medical treatment.
Often victims don't see their attackers or are attacked by someone they know. But in Uganda, survivors have very little chance of seeking justice against these crimes. Laura Salm-Reifescheid spoke to an acid attack victim and has this report from Uganda's capital, Kampala.
I had like someone was walking behind me. I was excited, thinking maybe it's a visitor. So I turned around and someone just splashed acid in my face and ran off.
Flavie Nampima stands outside her parents' bungalow in Uganda's capital, Kampala, and points to the spot where a stranger attacked her with acid 5 years ago.
The acid splashed from me to the garage door. I think it was a lot.
The acid burned its way through the paint on the garage door. Its stains are still visible. Flavia's father had tried to paint them over, but they kept reappearing. For Flavia, they're a gruesome reminder of those horrid moments that changed her life forever.
I didn't know exactly what liquid was poured on me, so of course with time it started stinging and burning, so that's when I started crying.
Flavia remembers her clothes falling off her body reduced to mere shreds. She remembers running over to her neighbor, but her son only stared at her in shock. It took a long time until Flavia was finally admitted to Mulago, Kampala's biggest hospital. There, she was treated by Dr. Ben Kingi. The plastic surgeon is specialized on the treatment of acid and burn victims. Occasionally, Flavia still visits him in hospital. Dr. Kingi still remembers well how he was fighting for Flavia's life back then.
There was this young, beautiful girl who suddenly had these injuries which were terrible. What struck me about her was her bravery. She was very brave and she would walk with her head high.
For the surgeon, acid attacks are one of the most brutal acts of violence. The acid penetrates skin and tissue right down to the bones. It melts the cartilage, destroys the nose and renders you deaf and blind in no time. 13 out of 100 patients do not survive their injuries.
In the case of acid, it sticks on the skin and it reacts with the skin. And even if you wash the surface, some of it is gone into the skin and it causes death of the cells on a progressive way. The ideal thing would have been to cut off the injured skin at the earliest possible time, but you'd have a lot of bleeding and you'd not know what part of the face you can cut and how deep you can cut. So what we generally do is to wait for it to the living tissue to separate from the dead tissue. And because that takes a long time, there is a lot of reaction. And the reaction causes further scarring and disfigurement.
When Flavia was admitted to the hospital, she had no idea what she was in for. Today, she's gained a healthy distance to recall these moments soberly.
I wasn't sure what acid does, so I kept telling my mom, Mommy, I have to go back to school. I have an assignment I have to hand in tomorrow. So I thought it was just one night and I'll be out. So it kept sinking in that I was really badly off. It was hard, as angry, as sad, as depressed, as crying all the time. It was really tough. I missed what I looked like. I was not accepting that this is what I was going to look like for the rest of my life.
Flavia stays in hospital for 7 months. Time and again, the doctors perform surgeries on her eyes, her nose and her mouth. Skin is grafted. At one point, while changing bandages, her left ear fell off. It took years until all necessary operations were finished. Today, thick scar tissue covers her face, her neck, her arms and her torso.
All I wanted was to get back my skin and look pretty again.
In Uganda, 55% of acid victims are women. The perpetrators are mostly men. They aim for the face or for the genitals to destroy the woman's beauty. Sometimes jealous wives, ex-lovers or mothers-in-law also use acid. Every year around 1,500 attacks are recorded worldwide, but the actual figure is much higher. The survivors often do not have the means to report the perpetrator to a corrupt police force, or they're financially dependent on their attackers. Until today, Flavia does not know who attacked her. She had suspected her ex-boyfriend. Shortly before the incident, she had broken off the relationship. He had become too possessive. She also thinks it possible he hired someone to throw the acid. In Uganda, that is actually often the case. But in the end, Flavia had no proof, no evidence, nothing.
I kept asking myself why, like, what did I do? Like, I would really want to meet that person and just ask them, what did I do to you?
Survivors of acid attacks are often stigmatized for the rest of their lives and rejected by society. Not the perpetrators, but the victims are blamed. A skewed logic says that the victim provoked the attack and is therefore responsible. Many survivors lose their eyesight, cannot work anymore, and become dependent on others. Often the husbands or relatives abandon them to their own fate. But Flavia has been lucky in this respect at least. Her family and friends stood by her. Still, after she was released from hospital, she did not dare to venture outside for many months. And for years, she hid her scars behind sunglasses, under scarves and wigs, and only wore long-sleeved shirts and high-neck tops. The reaction of others left her speechless and hurt.
See how people stare at you. And for the children, for it's worse. They stare and point and say something and run off. It was sad. I didn't want to be around people.
Today, Flavia's learned to cope with all this.
This is me. Even if I cover or I don't, it will still be there. And then I'm like, other people will just have to accept me the way I am.
Every Sunday, she slips into a sexy short dress and high heels, pins up her hair, puts on makeup, and takes a taxi to the city centre. The dance floor under the palm-thatched roof of a quaint pavilion is brimming with people. The mood is ecstatic. Hugs and kisses await Flavia, and one of the most talented dancers immediately drags her to the floor. Flavia's been coming here for some months now. After the attack, a friend of hers had taught her the basic moves. But when she attended her first public salsa night, she just hid and thought, why would a boy ever want to dance with me? But she was very good, and soon more and more guys asked her to dance, and Flavia realized that she still is attractive. And today, Flavia even thinks that she's a better person than before the attack. The acid did not make her shrink, but grow.
It has taught me to appreciate inner beauty more, even in other people. So I try to make sure that my heart is something I'm proud of.
Laura Salm-Reifescheid there, reporting from Kampala in Uganda. And if you happen to be in Germany this year, there's an exhibition at the State Museum for Ethnology in Munich called Invisible, profiling women who have survived acid attacks. It runs until January.
Vietnam's complicated relationship with China has been particularly fraught over the last few months after Beijing deployed a $1 billion oil drilling platform in waters also claimed by Vietnam. Last week, the oil rig was removed to avoid an oncoming typhoon, but there's little hope the slight easing of tensions will last for long.
Adding fuel to the fire is one of Vietnam's best-known critics of the government's close ties with China, Professor Thuong Lai, a former advisor to two prime ministers. Thuong Lai has been ostracised for his views and even been prevented from publishing some of his research critical of the government. Marion Brown met him at his home in Ho Chi Minh City.
Golden afternoon light mottles the tarmac of a leafy residential district in Ho Chi Minh City. Some passers-by trot past in suits, Others trudge along laden with shopping bags branded with supermarket logos. On the pavement, bent over his stick, an older man with a shock of white hair is waiting for me as I step out of the taxi. He is Ngutin Phuoc Thuong, better known as Professor Thuong Lai, which means future in Vietnamese. Former head of the Vietnam Institute of Sociology, Thuong was advisor to two prime ministers between 1991 and 2006. He is now one of Vietnam's most outspoken commentators on extremely sensitive topics, the government's relationship with China and the future of the Vietnamese Communist Party. In a comfortable living room overlooking the humming metropolis, Thuong pours some green tea. As we drink, he explains why, despite the country's official name of the Socialist Republic of Vietnam, socialism does not exist in Vietnam.
Socialism is theoretical. If we analyze it, we can seek its real value in Western countries. There, the targets set by socialism are being deployed, while in Vietnam, there's no true socialism, only on paper. Because of my thinking, Mr. Vo Van Kiet appointed me as his advisor.
Prime Minister Vo Van Kiet was known as a supporter of economic and political reform, advocating a stronger role for private business and urging the Communist Party to loosen its grip on government. He also backed the normalization of diplomatic relations with the United States.
We, the people who counseled and who supported him, believed that if Vo Van Kiet held the position of General Secretary, the country would change quickly. However, the forces which sided with China at that moment tried to hamper him and found ways to obstruct him.
Like his former boss, Thuong is a strong advocate of closer ties with the United States, despite the country's history. This, he says, is the best way to counter China gobbling up Vietnamese territory in the South China Sea. The issue reached a nadir in recent months after China deployed an oil drilling platform and flotilla of around 100 vessels to waters also claimed by Vietnam, which many condemned as violating international maritime law. The arrival of a typhoon prompted the removal of the oil rig last week.
By sending the oil rig and many more to come into the East Sea, the South China Sea, China's face has never been so ugly under the eyes of Vietnamese people, the area of Southeast Asia and Asia, and the whole world as well.
The professor has long been sidelined for his views. He is not allowed to write for prominent Vietnamese newspapers, and he has been prevented from publishing some of his research for public consumption. Despite this, he has not relinquished his party membership.
I've been a member of the party for 56 years, and frankly speaking, if I had to choose my path for my youth again, I would choose the same one. I feel no regret or shame at all, unlike some other people. I raised a gun to fight the French when I was just 14 years old. I left my family and joined the army. In 1954, when the war against the French ended, I came back to Hanoi. Then I pursued my studies and became a scientist.
The Communist Party was the only thing that could unite the nation to win independence and achieve a victory which triggered the collapse of colonialism across the world, he said. But he stays for other reasons too.
Now I'm very proud of my youth and of how I grew up. I've never regretted being a party member. Some people ask me why I remain in the party. I tell them that I stay in the party so that I can fight to get rid of the depraved elements who are leading the party and push the country forward. I believe that in the party there are many patriots.
As the light fades into evening and the traffic noise outside begins to subside, Thuong starts to look tired. He has cancer and has difficulty walking. Before I go, he tells me about an encounter he had with then-recently elected General Secretary of the Communist Party, Ngutin Phu Chop, at a convention held by the Fatherland Front in 2011.
When he saw me, he came to me and went to shake my hand. I took his hand and said, "Congratulations, you are now the General Secretary." He knew that I understood him well and he understood me well, so he asked me, "You are congratulating me." I said, "I must," at least for now.
The next convention is in September, but Tuong says this time he will not shake the party chief's hand. Instead, he will ask him to resign.
That report was by Marion Brown in Ho Chi Minh City in Vietnam.
In 1998, Matt Lewis was a 23-year-old fresh-faced college graduate when he took a job as a scientific observer on the fishing vessel Suda Harvard. The boat, along with its 38 crew members, set sail to the Southern Ocean near Antarctica to fish. Matt thought he would spend his time there logging his observations.
But his job suddenly turned to one of survival after a massive storm hit the boat and sank it. Now aged 40, Matt's finally able to talk about this traumatic event in his new book, Last Man Off. Earlier, he joined us on the line from Aberdeen to tell us his story.
We didn't know that the storm was coming, but later on we were to learn that a big polar low had swept up from Antarctica, and so the wind picked up, the swell picked up, and we woke up to go out on deck, and the waves were as high as the roof of your house, is the, I think, the scary statistic. They're 10 metres or more in height. And I remember at 10 o'clock in the morning seeing shadows on the deck from the waves. And I looked at the sun and I thought that really, you should not be getting shadows on the deck.
When you saw these waves, I mean, you'd seen a lot of choppy conditions during the trip, but on this particular day, did you at any time think, my God, this boat's going to sink?
No. We had had, you know, rough conditions before. The waves had been big, certainly nearly as big as the day that we got into trouble. But when I went out on deck, I just looked around at the experienced fishermen around me for reassurance. They were all working, so I thought, well, we'll be fine. I just have to get on and do the job. And at no point did I think in the morning that the boat could sink.
So at what point did you realise that things were more serious than you'd expected?
In the afternoon when I went down to the factory deck. And that's an enclosed area down below the deck, sort of on the waterline. And the water, during my time in the factory, started to build up. So it went from a few millimetres swilling backwards and forwards to a few centimetres. And then at one point, the water went over the top of my boot. And I thought, that's the first time in 2 months I've got a wet foot. Something's, you know, this is much more serious. But even then, the fishermen were quite relaxed. And it wasn't until probably half an hour later that I thought we were in really serious trouble.
And how did events unfold then? How much time did you have before the boat actually sank?
I think I got a wet foot probably before 3 o'clock. We were really struggling with the pumps for the next 40 minutes or so, and the ship sank, or we boarded life rafts at 4 o'clock, and the ship sank shortly after. So it all went wrong quite quickly.
And what was the atmosphere on the boat like? I mean, was it orderly, or was there panic, or how did you leave the ship?
I don't think orderly would be the word, because that implies some sort of command, and sadly our skipper and fishing master weren't given the commands that we needed them to. They weren't coordinating the efforts, but it wasn't chaos. So I think the crew, who are mostly South African and Namibian, I think there's a credit to them that at no point did it descend into panic or chaos. And there were fears that there were going to be fights for spaces on rafts and things, you know, that there would be violence. But there was no chaos, no violence. Everybody went to the back of the boat.
Matt, you were part of a 38-person crew. Yeah. How many people survived?
21. So we lost 17 crew and officers on that single day. And in my life raft, 10 out of 17 men died.
And how was it that you managed to survive while others didn't?
Partly because I was wearing a slightly better suit. I was wearing what's called a flotation suit or a deck suit. It's just got a little bit of insulation in it. It wasn't sealed to keep the water out, but it just helped me a bit to stay a little bit warmer. And partly because I fought as hard as I could to survive. And maybe I'm lucky coming from Scotland. Some of the guys had come from Namibia. They just weren't acclimatized to the conditions that we faced. So when we ended up in seawater at -1 degrees... I was lucky that I didn't go into cold water shock, and I didn't collapse. And some of the men in my life raft probably died within minutes of entering the water.
For how long were you actually stuck out at sea for?
We were adrift in a life raft for almost 4 hours, which doesn't sound like very long, does it? Obviously, I wasn't looking at my watch much during the time in the life raft. But we got into the life raft at about 4 o'clock. And we were rescued just after about 7:30 at night. But it was so long that the darkness had fallen, and I knew that time was passing, but I didn't know how long we could cling on, and I didn't see how we could last until the morning, and I didn't see how we could be rescued until it was light, because our life raft was drifting at night with no light on it in the Southern Ocean.
What were you guys talking about in these life rafts? Or was there any conversation at all?
No, there was no conversation, there was no banter. We had some short conversations at the start, but some people wailed and then went quiet. But for a lot of the time, we just waited, and you'd hear somebody would call you across the raft for some help with sealing down a hatch or something like that. But for the rest of the time, we were just each locked in our own little battle to survive. It wasn't being selfish. It was just that you were just trying so hard just to stay alive, and there wasn't much to talk about. There was no optimism. I had a hunch that the skipper had sent out a mayday, because I had heard frantic voices on the radio as I'd gone through the bridge. We knew that the nearest boat that we knew of was 100 miles away. Too far.
So what was the very first thing you did when you were picked up and when you got aboard the vessel?
I fell flat on my face on the cold metal deck and said, thank God.
And did you just fall asleep of exhaustion, or couldn't you sleep? Or no, I mean, how did you spend the next couple of hours?
There was no tender welcome, like just snoozing. We were dragged semi-conscious through to a cold factory in the fishing boat and stripped naked on the deck and then hauled into a shower. And I remember thinking, good grief, you don't treat a casualty like this. You can't put them in a shower. And they put us in the shower to warm us up, and I turned around and actually turned the dial hotter, because the warmth was just so beautiful that I actually turned the shower hotter. And I thought, I don't care if it kills me, I need the warmth. And they carried us through then to a canteen on the boat and dried us and dressed us in borrowed clothes. And I flopped forward on the resting myself on the table and looked around, and there were the crew from the other life raft, the 14 men from the first life raft who'd been saved, were all looking at me. And gradually they brought through the other survivors from my life raft.
Do you still keep in contact with the other survivors or the loved ones of those who have died?
Well, we lost contact, and then because I started writing the book, I had to get back in touch with them, and that's been one of the big benefits of writing the book, was that I've actually made contact again with three or four of the crewmen, but also people from the boat that saved us. And beautifully, just less than a year ago, I think I got in contact with the captain of the boat that saved us, the Isla Camilla.
And how was that encounter?
It was just emails, but it was wonderful, because I got to tell him about the fulfilment of a promise that I made.
Which was?
When we were rescued by the boat, she was called the Isla Camilla, I had to find a way to thank them. And so a week later, we met some of the crew of the Isla Camilla in a pub in the Falkland Islands. And I couldn't find a way to express our gratitude to them. They turned their boat into a storm to come and save us, strangers. And so I promised Jesus Posada, who was the man who'd hauled me onto the Isla Camilla, and I promised him that if I had a daughter, I would call her Camilla after the boat. And 11 years later, I finally got to email Ernesto Sandoval, the captain of the Isla Camilla, and tell him that I had named my daughter Camilla.
Matt Lewis there talking to us from Aberdeen. And if you want to find out more about his book, you can go to his website, lastmanoff.com.
And that just about wraps up this week's show. Worldlink was produced by Claudia Rack, Charlotte Lomas and Neil King. And as always, if you'd like to hear any of the items featured on today's programme again, just go to dw.de/worldlink or look us up on iTunes. Worldlink is brought to you by DW in Bonn. But now I'm lying stapled to the floor. The ride that I jumped, not